You were either a Queen's Park supporter or a Sir Lennox supporter, but you went and watched the other side week about, and you wanted them to win all the games except when they played Queens, for example. And the Thirds were a great side to watch, pre-war internationalists like Jimmy Carabine, Jimmy Mason, and after the war, Bobby Mitchell, to say nothing of Philly Hartley, Gray McInnes coming nearer again.
The wonderful thing was that you could say 1939 Cup Final, 1923 Cup Final, 1956 Cup Final, and he would take you through the score, the attendance, the teams, the referee, major incidents during the game. And, you know, I would love to think that in 20 years' time I would have the same kind of recall as somehow did it.
What he achieved in so many and various fields is quite remarkable. I think the one word that maybe people will not use too often about Bob, but it's absolutely applicable, is energy. Bob had masses of energy, never sat still.
Can I suggest to you, Bob, that if your loyalties were torn between Third Lanark, going out of business, Queen's Park, you're struggling, you're something of a jinx.
Well, if in addition to, you add to that the support Somerset in the county championship, who are the least successful of the... But anybody can be a success worshipper, Chick. Anybody can be that.
I always had the sense of being in the presence of profoundly civilised man, and his interest in sport reminded us that sport, though it may be little more than a magnificent triviality, when Bob Crampsey was around, you knew that there was no need to worry about taking sport seriously.
Can I assume that if Queen's Park were to win the Scottish Cup this year, I don't know if you've still got a bowler hat, but if you have, would you eat it?
I don't think that's bizarre enough. I would have to dream up something even more odd than that. I think, as Jeeves used to say to Worcester, you know, in the PG Woodhouse books, a remote contingency, sir.
The distinctive voice may finally have been silenced, but memories and recollections of Bob Crampsey will live on. And what wonderful memories he's left us with. We'll hear from family, friends and colleagues during this programme, as we remember a truly great man. The remarkable life of Bob Crampsey started in a remarkable way, as his brother-in-law, the former Glasgow Evening Times sports writer John Quinn, recalls.
When Bob was born in 1930... It was said, now I don't know if it's absolutely correct, but it was said that he was the heaviest baby boy to be born in Glasgow because he weighed in at 13 pounds 10 ounces, which was a colossal weight in those days. He went to Holy Cross School, and from there he graduated obviously to Glasgow University, where he took a degree in history. And he went to the RAF, served in the RAF from, I think it was 1952 to 1955.
It was during that time in the RAF that Bob had a chance meeting with Arthur Montford, who one day would become the first presenter of the television programme Scotsport.
We met in a Lions tea shop corner house in London. It was a Saturday. I was in the army. He was in the RAF. We went in for a cup of tea. I was going to Highbury. He was going to Stamford Bridge. And we got chatting. How are you doing? Where are you from? And he was gently chiding me about my team, Morton, pinching the best players from Queen's Park, who helped us reach the final of the Scottish Cup the following year, unsuccessfully though it may be. So we became good friends, and after STV had been running for a while with John Wilson as a sports editor, I remember Bob working on radio with me, going to matches and so on, and I thought that he might make a good reporter for because his attention to detail, as you know, was always meticulous. So I invited him to come in for a modest audition, which I knew he would pass because he could talk on any subject you cared to offer him. Well, the idea was just to throw him a subject and ask for an ad-lib, and of course he could ad-lib forever. And he joined the Scotsport team with Alec Cameron, Archie Aitman, myself in the early days.
When I was a very young reporter, I used to work occasionally with a very old reporter, and this was in the 50s, Sandy Adamson, who said that he'd covered his first two Scottish Cup finals and his first two Open Championships using pigeons. And the pigeon stories were legion. You went to the game with an office junior, and if you worked for an Edinburgh paper, he was called the PCA, the Pigeon Control Assistant. He worked for a Glasgow paper who was called the GDB, the Glaikit Dooboy. And you went to the game with these and you wrote your wee piece, put it round the cylinder, give it to the GDB or the PCA as the case might be, and he threw it into the air, followed by an agonised shout of "Hearts have equalised."
He liked to do what I thought was a colour supplement piece in the programme. Between two matches would bring Bob in and he would talk about any subject and make it interesting. It wasn't just a learner's look at a subject. It would be pungent, it would be topical, it would be knowledgeable. And that's, I think, what Bob brought to the programme, just a bit of stature, dare I say it, a wee bit of class, and he was very good at that.
It was during his time in Scotsport that Bob witnessed what he and many others regarded as the greatest game of football ever played.
And welcome to a packed Hampden Park, Glasgow, as the champion of champions, Real Madrid, in their familiar all-white strip, prepare to kick off for the 1960 European Cup final. Real Madrid have Dominguez's goal.
Eintracht Frankfurt had beaten Rangers 6-1 in Germany and 6-3 at Ibrox. And therefore, people thought, everybody thought, I thought, that they must be the best side in the world. If you take 12 goals off Rangers, you must be the best football side in the world. So there was a certain amount of curiosity about to see this side, even amongst Rangers supporters. Rangers supporters came in quite large numbers to this particular match.
Chris, forward to Lindner, to Stein, who's not offside. Gets it in, Chris!
Quite a lot of people went thinking that the Germans would probably win. And, of course, scored the first goal after 20 minutes. And I remember we all looked at each other very smugly and said, yeah, of course. We know the game. We can read a game okay.
In the middle is Puskas. And it's a goal. A well-made goal. That is now a hat-trick for Puskas.
If somebody had said you would go to see a match and two players on the winning side will score a hat-trick, you would have thought it must have been very, very one way. But in actual fact, Eintracht were a very good attacking side. Real didn't win because Eintracht were rubbish. They won because they themselves were a superlatively good side.
And the whistle has gone. Real Madrid have done it again. It's magnificent. And the crowd just rising to them. Just listen.
I think phrases that irritate you from time to time crop up, and normally the beautiful game is one that irritates me no end, as it's usually followed a muddy brawl which has lasted for about 4 days, although they tell you it was 90 minutes. But you really did feel, looking at those 22 players and the way they played it, you thought this is a beautiful game when it's played well.
In 1974, there was great excitement in the west of Scotland with the launch of the commercial station Radio Clyde. The Saturday afternoon sports programme was to be presented by Richard Park, and Bob was top of their wanted list.
Well, I think he was highly respected, and when Jimmy Gordon and Alec Dixon were putting together a team for the Saturday afternoon sports programme, they looked no further than Bob the moment Jimmy asked him, because they'd been in Scottish television at the same time. Bob was absolutely up for it, and he loved all his sports passionately. So the chance to broadcast for what initially was 2.5 hours every Saturday afternoon was something that was right up Bob's alley. I think initially I was asked to do the show because I could work the equipment and Bob couldn't. So I just sat across from him and learned, you're seating yourself when you're across the studio from Bob Cramsey at the foot of the Buddha.
I knew him, I think I first met him professionally when we both worked together for Radio Clyde in the very early days of that radio station. And there's absolutely no doubt that Bob Cramsey was one of the rocks on which Radio Clyde's sport was built.
Celtic won the league under Jock Stein. He came on the programme and gave Bob, and indeed myself, a pasting for sitting in a studio every Saturday afternoon pontificating and never ever being a match. He said, you guys sitting there, how can you be saying all this stuff? You've never ever seen a player, And Bob said at the end of that programme, right, that's it. I want to go back out on the road. I want to go round. I want to watch the matches,
Richard Park and Chick Young there. At this point, I have to confess a personal interest. Having watched him for many years in Scotsport and listened to him on Radio Clyde, like many others, I was in awe of this man's seemingly endless knowledge. In the summer of 1987, just a year after he'd retired as rector of St Ambrose High School in Coatbridge, I was a sports producer working on BBC Radio Scotland's Sports Hour programme and wondered if maybe, just maybe, Bob could be persuaded to join us. We arranged to meet in the BBC canteen, and the deal was done over a cup of tea. Bob was on his way to the BBC. Over the next 14 years in Sportsound, he was to work with the likes of David Begg, Alistair Alexander, Gordon Smith, Chick Young and Richard Gordon. But first, let's hear from the controller of BBC Scotland, Ken Macquarie.
I think Bob had a fantastic relationship with his audience. He was both loved and respected by the audience, and to an extent that is quite rare in our industry. And Bob, for me, was classically both an educator and a storyteller, and nobody encapsulated the Wreathian trilogy, if you like, of inform, educate and entertain better than Bob.
Bob would never use 50 words where one would do. And I can remember about the get the cup up to my mouth, and he came back with the reply when I said about such and such. He said, yeah, indubitably. Now, it wasn't just an ordinary word, but as one word, it left me absolutely high and dry. And I then went back to look at the dictionary. Unquestionably, undoubtedly, he didn't use ordinary words. He always used words that made the listener go away and think.
Bob could look at a game and he could cast an eye over things, and he could see things that other people didn't necessarily see. And this is something I think that's important. He could be informative, but he was never dull.
It was like sitting with an encyclopedia. You probably need to go into Google nowadays to have something that matches up with Bob Crampsey's mind, because he just seemed to be able to produce the information at short notice and in the course of a discussion that we could all benefit from.
He would give you the most remarkable answers to the most difficult, you'd have thought, questions, but then in the most oblique ways, because he'd go away at a tangent and tell you that while there were 132,000 people at Hampden that particular afternoon, the traffic in Argyle Street just after the lighting up times at 4:10 p.m. was really heavy.
If it was a dreadful game, Bob said so. There was one wonderful, wonderful half-time summation that he gave us, and I think it was a Hibernian Raith Rovers game. Paul Mitchell did his half-time report, handed over to Bob, and he gave 40 seconds, the like of which I have never heard before.
Wraith resisted making a change, and Bob, Hibs couldn't capitalise.
They couldn't. I think Jim and Nicol had looked at the Hibs attack and decided they were all right. This is as if this game was being played in a gigantic barn in total darkness. Occasionally feeble gleams of cleverness from Kenny Miller and Paul Hartley and Craig Dargle illuminate the Stygian scene, and then it lapses back into impenetrable murk. Both sides left the field at half-time to a chorus of well-deserved booing.
Follow that if you can, John. Half-time, Easter Road, Hibs 0, Wraith 0.
He may have won the BBC's Brain of Britain and been a semi-finalist on Mastermind, but you would never have known that by talking to Bob. Among those to marvel at his towering intellect was the award-winning sports writer Hugh McIlvany.
He had a marvellously peculiar mind. He had that capacity to absorb and to retain and to understand. It was nothing to do with regurgitating material in some sort of crude form. It was all processed through a highly sensitive mind. It was extremely impressive, but the main thing was it was something that made you feel good about being with him. He wore his erudition lightly, Bob.
I think that from his early days, you know, Bob was a teacher, that desire to impart knowledge never left him, because for me he was one of the most generous individuals with his huge depth of knowledge, and that knowledge extended across so many different fields. We know him best, I suppose, from sport, but he was able to integrate poetry, the arts, film, the American musical, a whole worldview of his fellow human beings into his passion for sport. And it left you always left a conversation with Bob, or a broadcast from Bob, both richer in terms of your own knowledge, but also your perspective on the subject that he was telling you about.
He was an extremely modest man. Although he had all these qualifications for finished up only losing in the semi-final of Mastermind by 1 point and won the Brain of Britain in 1965. He would never boast about anything like that, Jeff. You had to find out. If you found out and asked him a question, he would certainly tell you the truth, but he wouldn't go about telling people about them at all. But he always liked a challenge. And when things like that came up, I think he was also on Crisscross Quiz at one time. He used to enter all of these things, and it was just a challenge. It wasn't for any monetary gain or anything like that. But he really did like a challenge in all walks of life.
I remember vividly the week that it was announced that he'd won Brain of Britain. We tried to prize it out of him, but he said no. He said, but it's one deceit, you see. You'll have to wait till the weekend. And of course, it's common knowledge now that he was away playing cricket, I think, in Oban, when the programme went out and he was proclaimed as Brain of Britain. Totally modest, would love to have told us, but stuck to the contract, didn't tell us. And I remember listening to the final, and he was absolutely brilliant. His wide range of knowledge was phenomenal.
For more than 30 years, Bob's Now You Know column in the Glasgow Evening Times was essential reading for sports fans. Readers continually challenged him to come up with the answers to increasingly diverse and vague questions. It was brother-in-law John Quinn who recommended Bob for the job.
So when I asked Bob if he would like to do it, he said, what a wonderful challenge that would be. He said, I would love to do that. He said, but I would maybe have to try it out, first of all, to see if I suited them and if they suited me.
Well, the column itself's been going since about 1911. I didn't write it then. I took it over 1975, and we think it's probably the longest-running sports column in Britain.
What's the most popular question you get asked?
If I have time, it's three questions. The first one comes from a bloke called Paddy the Maddy Croy.
Right.
And he says, I am told that Celtic once scored 7 goals against Rangers. Can this be possible? You know that he's not really in need of the information. You know that he was there. He could give you every goal. So you say, right, League Cup Final 57, sit back and wait for the next letter from staunch and true Lark Hall. With a felicity you wouldn't expect, says, I am told, though I can scarce credit it, right, that Rangers once scored 8 goals.
Right.
Surely this isn't possible. So you say, yes, 1st of January 1943, Southern League, teams scorers. You sit back and wait for Paddy the Maddy's riposte, which is, we two men sent off and it was during the war, it doesn't count.
I would say to him, did you know that Stanley Matthews played for Morton during the war? Yes, he actually played 14 games and he was married in Bonnyton Moor Clubhouse. How did you know that? Well, I remember reading it somewhere. Stuff like that he would produce, you know, literally by reply. Amazing man.
Bob could talk to you about absolutely anything, and I put that to the test. One time, we were away on a trip for a couple of days, and I fired at him a random selection of topics, anything I could think of, whatever the topic. Bob could spend 4 or 5 minutes, not rambling, not scratching the surface, but giving you in-depth analysis and discussion and information. I mean, it just absolutely astonishing. So an incredible intellect, as I say, the sharpest of minds, and yet incapable of operating any kind of technical equipment.
He was down at Capello, and I would fade up the line to see if he was there, and he never was, you know. Studio to Bob Crampsey, come in, please. There'd be a silence. Studio to Bob Crampsey. And then about 60 seconds later, a voice would say, hello, hello, Paul, can you hear me? Bob here. Greenock. Bob, can you hear us? Silence. Bob, you know. And then, Bob, oh, yeah, oh, I think I can hear it distantly. Yes, yes, oh, right, ready. When are you coming to me? I said, in 60 seconds time. So then I would introduce, right, you know, Morton against Celtic. Bob Cramps. Bob. Hello. It was very amusing.
A DIY man, he was certainly NOT. He had no knowledge whatsoever of DIY and no interest in it. If anything went wrong, he would just shout, Ronnie, could you fix this? And his dutiful wife would take him and put things to rights. But I remember once there was an occasion when Siobhan, his youngest daughter, was in the house, and Bob was working away on his Now You Know column, sitting at the kitchen table, and he shouted, Siobhan, come and take this hairdressing implement away from the table. And she said, Dad, I don't use a hairdressing implement. He said, well, there's a hairdressing implement here. Please come and remove it. And she went through and she lifted this implement and said, Dad, this is a Phillips screwdriver.
Throughout his life, Bob was fascinated by travel and words, especially foreign languages. John Quinn again.
He was particularly good at French. He had a marvellous fluency in French and the most beautiful French accent. And this was actually hammered home to us one day when we were discussing. When he was a teenager, he went on a hitchhiking tour of Europe. And he was very much a his own man. He went everywhere on his own. And he got a lift in a car in Calais, just to make over to the other side. And there was a big posh car with a man and his family in it. And they spoke French all the way until the man let him out at the south of France, and only then did Bert speak to him in English, and the man realised that he wasn't speaking to a Frenchman.
He said, well, we're going to Cuba, I said, what on earth takes you to Cuba, Fidel Castro territory? He said, well, he said, in my last year at school, he said, we're trying to do a feature on Cuba and Fidel Castro, but I couldn't find a decent book. So I'm going out to Cuba, I'm going there for 3 weeks, and when I come back, I'm going to write a book, which now I understand is still the classic school fifth and sixth year textbook for Fidel Castro and Cuba. He thought it was a good idea, so he did it.
I'm going to Cuba. And he said, oh, he said, you must go and visit the Museum of Anthropology. And I said to him, Bob, it's a very unusual name for a discotheque, but I promise you I'll go and visit it. And he always quoted that story back at me. And, you know, I went to Cuba, and I can't say that the Museum of Anthropology was going to be first on my list, but I made myself go there because I couldn't face him. I couldn't face him if I hadn't gone.
He had a great love of travel. He travelled to very many different countries. He particularly liked going to America. And one of the reasons for that, I would imagine, would be that in 1970, he won a Churchill Fellowship Award, which gave him a grant of £1,600, which enabled him to go to America for 3 months to do some research and some looking for background of things. He was fascinated with the American Civil War, and being in Washington for 3 months, he had a love of going to libraries and places like museums, and he really enhanced his knowledge of the American Civil War there.
I always felt that Bob was a man of happy passions, a man whose passions enriched his life and enriched the lives of a lot of other people too. He had a cast of mind that ensured that if Bob had an enthusiasm about something, he'd make himself very knowledgeable about it. I think in that sense, he represented quite seriously the great Scottish tradition of intellectual inquiry.
It was some time, I'd known him for some time before I discovered his love for cricket, that he would go down and watch his beloved Somerset, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 times during the season. And this, it seemed almost incongruous to me that a man who loved Scottish football in the way that he did also loved English county cricket and had just as an encyclopedic knowledge on that as he did on football.
The other thing about Bob Cramsey was he was a fantastic after-dinner speaker. Great humour. You never just got joke after joke. You got something, you got a message. And he was particularly proud of one day when he spoke at Lord's for the MCC at lunchtime, and he then, in the evening, spoke at St Andrews for the RNA. So, arguably, British sport's two most famous governing bodies, Bob Cramsey spoke at their dinners on the same day, and he said, not bad for a wee teacher for Glasgow.
It was incredible. I mean, I remember one of the last time, I think it was in his house, and I always liked to go into his, it was like a parlour, not a lounge, Bob had in his house, to see what he was reading, what he was doing. And he was reading Mein Kampf, but he was reading it in German, because he said that it was one or two things, the translations he didn't agree with, into English. So he was reading Mein Kampf in German. I mean, there are legendary stories about him teaching himself Portuguese in an afternoon.
The thing that relaxed him more than anything else was to sit at his grand piano and play the piano. If he had a particularly hectic day at school, he would come in immediately, have a cup of tea, cup of coffee, and go and sit in the lounge, play the piano for half an hour, and that relaxed him. He had a wonderful knowledge of the American musicals, possibly gained when he toured in America for those 3 months. But Stephen Sondheim, the American composer, was one of his big favourites. But he also had a great love and a great knowledge of Gilbert and Sullivan. And these were the things that he found a lot of enjoyment in, playing the piano. He was forever saying to us, now, guess this composer and what have you, would run through some great tunes, you know. Marvellous.
Although Bob gave up working on Sports Sound in 2001, he was still in demand as a contributor to a wide variety of programmes, despite the onset of Parkinson's disease. Just a few months before his death, he and his wife Ronnie celebrated 50 years of marriage with their four daughters, Alison, Fiona, Marion and Siobhan, and their grandchildren. His last weeks were spent in Mearnskirk House, where he was cared for. On my final visit to see him, I took a copy of a novel he wrote many years ago called The Manager. Although very ill by now and barely able to speak, I held the book up in front of him, and in an instant, those bright blue eyes sparkled in recognition. He celebrated his 78th birthday with a big cake and his family at his bedside just 19 days before he passed away. He may be gone, but oh, what a legacy he leaves. You may have seen him on television or heard him on the radio.
You may have read one of his books or been at a dinner where he was speaking. You might even have been taught by him. But for anyone fortunate enough to have known Bob Cramsey, I think we'd all agree it was an experience to enrich your life.
He had this way of connecting with anyone and everyone, and his recall was wonderful. You know, he remembered your family and he remembered your likes and dislikes and interests. He always made you feel special, there's no question about that.
I remember Bob with the greatest of affection, you know, and I shall never forget Bob, and I shall never forget those early days in Clyde, and I would sum him up as one of the most dedicated professional broadcasters I've ever met in my life.
In many ways, in the early days of Scotsport in particular, we were pioneers. We were doing something that none of us had ever done before. We were a great team, and I'm proud to think that Bob was part of it.
I always felt about Bob Cramsey that he were better for an hour in his company. He was just a fantastic human being. He had wonderful warmth and humour, but he was interested in you, not just in himself.
A great joy to be with, and a great man who contributed a lot to Scottish football and Scottish sport.
We all loved him as well, as you say, working along with him. Everybody had so much respect for him, not only in terms of his intelligence and his knowledge, but in terms of his manner too and the type of person he was.
Bob had a warmth for me that I really, really appreciated, and I just had a huge affection for him, and I have precious, precious memories that I will retain till the day I die.
Bob will be remembered as a broadcaster who was, in the true sense of the word, unique in the range and depth of his knowledge. We will simply not see Bob's like again.
It's entirely natural that people say of Bob that he was something of a Renaissance man. He certainly qualified for that description. And anybody who thinks that his only significance in Scottish life was in sport hasn't been paying much attention. In that way, it's clear that Scotland has lost somebody pretty important. And I think if we say of Bob that he was pretty important, I think he'd be satisfied with that.
You can't be associated with somebody for more than, well, best part of 50 years now, without learning their innermost thoughts and what have you. And although it's terribly sad, we can console ourselves by looking back at some of the great enjoyable times we've had together as a family and on a one-to-one basis. I mean, 5 minutes in the company of Bob was money in the bank.
For old Mount Florida boys like what I am, we spit us at the crowds of today, 50,000. Having been brought up in crowds of 150,000, or put it another way, that's three modern Hamdens. One has to be careful at the same time that although 150,000 people were there, 150,000 people did not actually see the game. One chap who was at the 1937 Aberdeen Celtic final has described this beautifully. He said that for his 3-6 he got a view of the clock and the back of the man in front of him's neck. He said it was quite a nice neck, well washed and all that, but hardly worth 4-6.
Can I say thanks very much? It's been a great pleasure to work with everybody here without exception. That shows two things. I'm easy to get on with and there's no discrimination whatsoever.